are listening to a free version of Majority Report with Sam Steeder. To support this show and get another 15 minutes of daily program, go to majority.fm, please.
The Majority Report with Sam Steeder.
It is Monday, July 23rd, 2018. My name is Sam Steeder. This is the five-time award-winning Majority Report. We are broadcasting live steps from the industrially ravaged Gowanus Canal in the heartland of America, downtown Brooklyn, USA. On the program today, Alyssa Quart on Squeezed, Why Our Families Can't Afford America. Also on the program, Donald Trump threatens Iran. It has nothing to do with Paul Manafort's trial, which starts in just a day or two. Carter Page's FISA's docs released. Devin Nunes seems to have a Devin Nunes problem. Meanwhile, Brett Kavanaugh has a Brett Kavanaugh problem. And a poll shows, no shit, Republicans love Trump. Barbara Lee announces a leadership bid in the Democratic caucus. Donald Trump upset that North Korea still has nukes, even after he pretended they were going to get rid of those nukes. And a Trump administration loophole now makes it much easier for the U.S. to sell weapons to killers of civilians. Mike Cernovich and his squad of white supremacists and cheerleaders of white supremacists get the Guardians of the Galaxy director James Gunn fired for 10-year-old tweets that were already deleted. And lastly, Barbara LaTalian, the Massachusetts state senator running for Congress now in Massachusetts, who duped Fox News into airing a rebuke to Trump and his kidnapping policies, will be joining us for a brief talk on how she managed to pull that off. All this and more on today's program. Yes, ladies and gentlemen, we are loaded for bear. Look, I'm just going to touch on this briefly, and tomorrow we're going to do some news, and I'm going to cover this Cernovich thing, and frankly, I'll probably talk a little bit more. We may touch on James Comey's new role as a Democratic political advisor.
He's so messy.
He's very messy.
Jesus.
But for those who didn't hear, and I heard this late. I was off Twitter until, I don't know, Saturday night, maybe it was. I was solo with the kiddies, and so I try not to engage on Twitter because that's it's like quicksand for me. And if I take one step, I sink even deeper, and then all of a sudden my kids are looking at me, going, just looking with a why expression on their face. But apparently, this director James Gunn, who I'm not familiar with, back in the day, used to fancy himself a provocateur and a comedian, and just wrote a bunch of nasty, not terribly good jokes in some instances. I don't know. I didn't even see them in context. But out of context, they didn't, you know, they're not particularly hilarious or anything other than crude. Apparently, he had already deleted these a long time ago. Nevertheless, he was fired by Marvel and Disney when Mike Cernovich and Jack Posobiec, what? How do you pronounce? How do you?
Posobiec.
Are you sure that? I think you pronounce it Bumblejack.
Bumblejack.
Bumblejack. I have to concede. I've never run into him on Bumble, but I don't have mine set for philanderers. Anyways, look, the gist of this is one does not need to defend old tweets that have already been disavowed by someone to say that these corporations are making a mistake by allowing a pro-date rape, or I should say, to be more accurate, a date rape denier, someone who is teaching people how to avoid charges of date rape after the fact, someone who had to plead down to a misdemeanor charge when they were accused of rape only after reportedly having private investigators intimidate the victim, someone who is a cheerleader for white supremacy, someone who propagated the Pizzagate story until there was a shooting, then subsequently lied about it, someone who delivered false documents attempting to smear Chuck Schumer, not to mention my run-in with him, but I'm not terribly concerned about that. And he's doing it because he's going after Trump critics. Now, I know Dave Rubin's probably on a tear right now about this. His Twitter feed in terms of free speech has probably just gone ballistic. And look, here's the thing about the hypocrisy also involved in Disney. When they hired, who was it? Who just got fired? I can't even remember her name now.
The director?
No, the ABC show. The big ABC.
Roseanne.
When they hired her, they said, look, a lot of those tweets are in the past. And everybody seemed to have no problem with that. I don't know if she disavowed them or maybe she did. It was only when she tweeted while she was under their, having been hired by them and on their show and doing it unabashedly, tweeting racist stuff. So there's a clear hypocrisy and lack of policy that these corporations are adhering to. And they've got to adhere to a consistent policy and not allow these alt-right figures, these white supremacist fans, to intimidate people. And they should also know that the fact is, I now know that Mike Cernovich has no constituency. He has a bunch of bots that he has paid for. And if he can get maybe Donald Trump Jr. to retweet something, then maybe that it gets a little bit more attention, but nothing significant. The emails that undoubtedly they received are from fake sources, because that's what happened with me. So we'll talk more about this going forward. But Disney, Marvel, the rest of them making a huge, huge mistake. I also just want to say I apologize that we do not have the Cernovich documentary ready to go yet, because this is exactly the type of instance where on the moment something like this starts to brew, executives at these companies need to see who it is that they're taking their moral cues from. All right, let's get to this clip, because we're going to have this guest on the program later. This is pretty amazing. Or wait a second, I guess I should just do these first. So we get another box of liquid IV. It is basically a powder. You mix it with your water. It fuels tough workouts, helps prevent cramping, fatigue, promotes healthy post-workout recovery. It is great to rehydrate yourself. It's good for travelers, prevents jet lag. Maybe if you've gone out, Michael, and you've spent, you've gone a little bit too crazy, you don't want to call in and pretend like you have some type of fake mystery illness. You can get some quick hydration relief by a packet of these in a glass of water.
Well, I'm allergic, unfortunately. I can't.
Yeah, I am. I'm sure.
I love
sure.
the product. I just
it's the water you're allergic
it's the water.
To, right? I have found I save mine. I always take a bunch of packets to Vegas now. I'm not saying that I engage in a lot of drinking in Vegas, but I engage in a lot of drinking in Vegas when I go.
Up on the IV.
Well, everybody it's hears my voice time. The next morning. No, but it's great. And it's a non-GMO electrolyte drink. It's vegan, free of gluten, no dairy, no soy. It provides the same hydration as drinking 2 to 3 bottles of water. It does so faster and more efficiently than water alone. And it contains 5 essential vitamins, including vitamin C. It has got as much potassium as a banana. Donates 1 serving to people in need for every order placed. I love this stuff. I know you will too. Liquid IV. Right now, my listeners get 20% off of Liquid IV. It's liquid-iv.com. When you see, use my code MAJORITY at checkout. That's 20% off anything you order on Liquid IV's website. Go to liquid-iv.com. Enter my promo code MAJORITY. Get your savings. Start getting better hydration now. liquid-iv.com, promo code MAJORITY. Don't wait. Get hydrated today. And folks, I've said this a million times. Brendan sits in this office because of ZipRecruiter. Hiring used to be hard. Multiple job sites, stacks of resumes, confusing review process. But today, it's much easier. Even I could do this. ZipRecruiter.com/majority. The one place to go to get it done. It sends your job to over 100 of the web's leading job boards. They don't stop there. With their powerful matching technology, ZipRecruiter scans thousands of resumes to find people with the right experience, invites them to apply to your job. They go out and grab people for you. ZipRecruiter is so effective that 80% of employers get a quality candidate through the site within one day. I had a ton of qualified people. We got even more and more, and the cream rose to the top, Brendan.
Thank you, ZipRecruiter.
With results like that, how did you end up
Seriously,
getting it? Did
though.
You go directly to ZipRecruiter? Or?
Yeah, those were the doldrums, let me tell you.
Tough times for you.
I'm still getting my severance package, though.
ZipRecruiter delivered you. The highest rated hiring site in America. Now my listeners can try ZipRecruiter for free at this address, ZipRecruiter.com/majority. That's ZipRecruiter.com/majority. ZipRecruiter, ZipRecruiter.com/majority. Check it out, folks. It's the smartest way to hire. All right, so let's play this clip quickly. There's 2 clips. So Fox and Friends got very excited because there was a Democratic candidate at in Arizona running for the endorsement of the political grassroots campaign, something like that. And this is like a big debate.
Grassroots Political Action Committee in Tucson,
PAC,
Arizona.
Right, okay, in Tucson. Sponsored the debate. And they're running for Congress. And, well, here, I'll let Fox and Friends describe the scene for you.
In Arizona's 2nd Congressional District, there was a debate, and one of the candidates, she got booed a number of times for basically defending ICE and saying some things that you might find pretty rational. Listen to this.
I just want to be really clear. If you would have declared your support for ICE agents without any increased oversight. Would you have supported Democratic leadership in condemning Ms. Waters' comments?
So that's Ann Kirkpatrick, who is known, I don't know if you would frame it as moderate, but a reasonable member of the Democratic Party. She's in a debate, and she's asked, would you support ICE, and should we condemn Maxine Waters saying you should harass people that support Trump. Courageously, she raised her hand. Remember when President Trump raised his hand saying, will you abide by? It takes courage to be the only one to raise your hand. Sometimes it cuts for you in Trump's case. I wonder whether in this case it will hurt her with the grassroots who have clearly moved further left.
It probably will, but you know what? She doesn't lose her soul in all of this. And
Oh, there's Abby Huntsman speaking of losing her soul.
You wouldn't want to compromise your soul for criticizing a fascist kidnap organization.
Right. There you go. But just Abby Huntsman really describing the process of soul leaving. So Fox is so excited because they have this Democrat who's, you know, I wouldn't say she's moderate, but
reasonable.
She's reasonable. Incidentally, what is it? Like only 38% of the country now supports ICE. Is that what it is?
Yes.
And So she's to the right of the country on this.
She's reasonably pro kidnapping.
So what will Fox do? Well, and it makes sense. We're gonna reach out. We're gonna book this person on our show, and so they reach out and book who they think is this Ann Kirkpatrick on their show.
And joining us now, that candidate, the only Democrat on stage to support ICE, Ann Kirkpatrick. Thank you for joining us. We appreciate it. Tell us why you do support ICE.
Good morning. I'm actually here to speak directly to Donald Trump. I feel that what's happening at the border is wrong. I'm a mother of four, and I believe that separating kids from their parents is illegal and inhumane. I'm actually Barbara Letalian. I'm a state senator representing a large immigrant community and running for Congress in Massachusetts. I keep thinking about what we're putting parents through, imagining how terrifying that must be for those families, imagining how it would feel not knowing if I'd ever see my kids again. We have to stop abducting children and ripping them from their parents' arms, putting kids in cages, making three-year-olds defend themselves in court.
Wait, but that practice has stopped at this point, Ms. Kirkpatrick, right?
Pause it for 1 second. Incidentally, no, it's not clear that it stopped. And certainly we know that there are at least 2,000 kids who are not reunited with their parents.
Patrick, right?
Score political points with your base.
Well, and families have been reunited with their families.
Again, my name is Barbara Letalian, and I refuse to believe that our only options are open borders or traumatized.
Okay. All right.
Let's move along.
That didn't go as planned.
For a second, so that's what happens sometimes. Time for a break?
Yeah.
Okay.
There you go.
We were expecting a concern troll from Arizona to say that we should treat each other with civility, and this woman's actually talking about the rights of children. So
yes,
not as planned.
Rather disgusting, critiquing kidnapping of children.
That's the last time we get excited about a Democrat.
Exactly. I think we've learned our lesson. That woman, Barbara Letalian, will be joining us later in the program. But first, we're going to take a quick break. When we come back, Alyssa Quart on her book, Squeezed, Why Our Families Can't Afford America.
Coming. All the while.
We are back. Sam Cedar on the Majority Report on the phone. It is a pleasure to welcome to the program the executive director of the Economic Hardship Reporting Project and the author of Squeezed, Why Our Families Can't Afford America, Alyssa Quart. Alyssa, welcome to the program.
Oh, it's a pleasure to be here, Sam.
So, all right, let's start with the notion of, and you have coined this term, the middle precariat. Tell us what that means.
So the middle precariat describes middle-class workers, people who earn between $42,000, let's say, and $115,000, who are contingent, who are increasingly don't have pensions, they don't have job security. They thought they did everything right. They got college degrees, graduate degrees. Now they're working as librarians, lawyers, teachers, professors, even people in IT that I spoke to, and yet it doesn't quite add up. They're just not a secure class. We think of the middle class as humdrum, as, you know, man in the gray flannel suit. These people would love to be that, and instead they're kind of unstable.
And this, I mean, in many respects, this this work that you did here came out of your own situation. Just briefly tell us about that.
Yeah, so, well, I was pregnant with my daughter like 8 years ago, and I was a freelance writer. And I want to be clear, we had a lot better than a lot of people. We had savings. We were already older parents, so we had certain kind of reputation as journalists that we could rely on for work. But, you know, we were buying our own health insurance. It was really expensive. I was sick when I was pregnant. And so we started to go spend down our savings. And that just threw me, I call it the middle class vortex, where I just was like, oh, shoot, this is, this gives me a portal into the lives of so many people in this country who would, unlike us, we were finally able to get jobs at nonprofits, as it turned out, were not able to make it work. Journalists, you know, newspaper reporters, 50% have lost their work since 2005. And those people, you know, are not finding work necessarily or jobs that help them, you know, make a decent living. So that was, we were lucky.
And so when you set out to write about this, what did you have? I mean, tell me what your sort of your process was. And did you set out to look at, because you ended up looking at a series of different professions. I mean, how did you just tell us about how you settled on that approach and who you wanted to look at?
Yeah, so I'm drawn to very emotionally intense stories. so I get kind of sucked in by individuals. I'd be interviewing people, some people in the business of journalism call it auditioning, but I'd be interviewing people and I'd sort of be drawn to a particular person because for the quality of their story, the quality of the way they talked about their life. So that'd be my first interest. And then, you know, I was particularly interested in things like the teachers who drove Uber. And so there's a chapter called Uber Dads that's about school teachers in San Francisco and in other parts of California who are now driving Uber after school and on weekends. And that was just a shocking story to me. And the fact that Uber had a whole campaign to recruit teachers and nurses. And the fact that they made not enough money to live comfortably in these places and these teachers were grating at stop signs.
Grating at stop signs.
Indeed. And they were thinking about their curriculum when the, you know, lights were changing. That's what, you know, they were telling me these stories. And that, for me, again, it's like the emotional piece, but also like the sheer dystopic quality of some of these, what has happened to some of these professions. That was part of my selection process. Like if it was a very dramatic finding, I felt I had to include it.
And we should say, you know, I spoke to some of the teachers involved, I guess it was a week or two ago, in the strikes that took place in Oklahoma and in Arizona and in West Virginia. And that concept of people having to drive Ubers was like a shorthand for people as to when they wanted to sort of say how how squeezed, I guess, they were. So let's go through some of these specific stories, and then we'll move on to sort of what I really find fascinating about your book was the perspective that people had on this in relation to sort of the systemic problems that we're facing. But tell us a little bit about, are there specific stories that stick out for you? I know the you talk about adjunct professors. I have some family members who have been adjunct professors, and so I have a pretty good sense of the challenges they face. But tell us about some of the stories that stick out in your mind.
Well, you know, I profiled one woman in Chicago with a disabled son who was a literature professor, had gone to graduate school, was teaching at a really good college, Columbia College in Chicago, an art school, and she was, you know, making 20-something thousand per year. It was variable from year to year. She was teaching all the time. And, you know, I went with her to shop for food at Trader Joe's, and she was using food stamps. And, you know, just the whole experience of having had these dreams, do what you love. We talk about doing what you love. And then it just didn't help her or her family, you know, and they were pretty desperate at a certain point. Or her colleague, Justin Thomas, who was making $1,700 a class. He wanted to pay for ice cream and music lessons for his kid, you know, after he taught, whatever, six or seven classes a semester. Or a year, I'm sorry, maybe it was per year, per semester, a lot. And he, couldn't do that. And his daughter was like, I want ice cream. And the sheer number of people I spoke to who had this kind of experience, who were adjuncts, I talked to someone who was homeless, like living in her car, and was an adjunct. And it was not, and I had been an adjunct, so I was particularly passionate and, I guess, identified with their plight.
I know you, you touched on the school teachers, but tell us the story of Matt Barry, just to sort of get like a notion of how you break down sort of some of these numbers and, so that people get a sense of what we're talking about here. Because we can talk about that, but also this notion of the context in which you're living, right? I mean, there's some numbers that we throw around that I think for some places in the country, people would be like, that would be great if I made that.
Well, yeah. I mean, I don't know if you saw, you must have seen there was that recent thing that in the San Francisco area, $117,000 for a family counted as lower income.
Right.
Yeah, they would be. That this is the kind of environment we're talking about. Matt Barry was teaching in San Jose. He was in his early 30s. He and his wife were both teachers. They earned $69,000 each, which is, you know, getting up there. Sounds good. But then, you know, a starter home, 1,500 square feet, is $680,000. And the town where he taught, the houses were $1.5 million, some of them. And, you know, they were each paying additional money in health insurance. So that was... they're paying an additional $6,000. So it just started to kind of creep up on them. And that was when Barry started driving Uber when his wife got pregnant and she realized that they'd have these untoward expenses. And he wound up driving the parents of some of the children at the school he taught.
That's nuts. And what was the reaction of the parents who would see their kids' teachers? Or were they conscious of that? I mean, how did they respond?
You know, it wasn't just him. Other people had described driving the parents, and I think they were surprised. I mean, I definitely think students are surprised too. One of the adjuncts I spoke to made it part of her lesson plan to explain to the kids exactly how much the professors that were teaching them were actually making. And I think it's not a bad exercise to start having this kind of stuff part of our curriculum. So the people in the communities that are, especially these wealthy communities, are starting to realize they're depending on these workers to shape their kids' minds, but their wages, no matter, they might seem high in Iowa, but in San Jose, they're not keeping up with the cost of living.
And so let's talk a little bit about the sort of the, I guess the the perspective that people have about their situations. Because, you know, I guess it was a couple years ago now, I interviewed a British writer, author, who had traveled the country and talking to people who had lost their homes after the 2008 foreclosure crisis. And he said at that time that one of the things he noticed was the sort of the isolation and the shame that people felt, and the sense that they had really somehow screwed up, even though we know that this financial crisis was a systemic problem. And he said there was yet to be any sort of like shared sense that they were their predicament was a function of something systemic as opposed to their own decisions. And you, I mean, you are of the mind that people should not perceive it that way. But I'm curious, is like, what did you come across in terms of the way that people perceived their situation and how much they were responsible for it and how much it was a change in society? And I should just add that even today I'm reading a piece in Axios, of all places, that looks at being 30 years old today versus, you know, the mid to late 20th century, and how a 30-year-old is making much less today than they did 40 years ago in this country, relative to all
I mean, there's this...
Go ahead.
Yeah, sorry. There's this amazing stat. It was from some study that Raj Chetty did that was showing that someone born in the 1940s was 92% more likely by the time they were 30 to make more money than their parents, and someone born in the 80s was 50-50. It had a half chance of making as much or being as successful as their parents when they were 30. So it's a diminished kind of mobility and aspiration as well. But to the blame and the emotional question you just asked, I mean, I think I did see a lot of self-blame. I saw a lot. I mean, to be fair, a lot of the people I wrote about, I even coined this term to describe them, the hyper-educated poor, they were really self-aware. So they weren't necessarily the average Joe, let's say, some of my subjects. I mean, not all of them, but some of them. But they toggled back and forth between being aware of a system error that had gotten them here, like a bad tax reform, you know, housing prices that have risen astronomically and had been, you know, affected by development, just a system just geared against them. They knew that, but you can't help it, you know. When you're in that moment, and that was the moment where I was in that middle-class vortex when I was pregnant, you're sort of like, what did I do wrong? How did I get here? And why didn't I plan ahead? Or there are things that you think to yourself. You don't have to be a bootstrapper to feel that way. You can just simply feel like I'm underachieving and blame yourself. And the hope with this book for me was just to question that stigma and get people to be aware that they had internalized the stigma around it.
I mean, the point is that for an earlier generation, the idea of making a couple of mistakes would not inhibit your success, right? I mean, that's what it comes down to. Yes, you may have made a couple of mistakes, but the fact is that if you were born 30 or 40 years later, those mistakes would have been forgiven, and you'd still be in a much less stressful position than you are now.
Yeah, and I mean, even when you're looking, I mean, I did include people who were not as affluent in the book, like care workers and so forth. And I looked at some of the possibilities open to new immigrants in the earlier part of the 20th century. There was free nursing. There was, you know, adult education for people like my grandparents who were immigrants. That was either free or nominally priced, right? And now for the woman I profiled who was a care worker, you know, she wouldn't be able to get evening classes to be a nurse. If she had been a nurse back in Paraguay, she wouldn't be able to get that here for a reasonable amount. So she then was working as a caregiver. So there are these obstacles now. It's not just doing things wrong, but obstacles to entry of the middle class as well that didn't used to be there.
Talk about the rise of 1% television. I mean, I feel like we've touched on this on this program just sort of vaguely in many respects. But what's the impact of that?
Well, I was really interested because I found myself watching these shows like Billions and Ozark and Empire, Downton Abbey, right? The Crown. All these shows in which we're aspiring on some level or being asked to aspire to these inexplicably well-born characters who are really morally lax. They're twisted hedge fund guys. They're murderous. They're, you know, decadent aristocrats. And yet the shows are sort of created so we want to be them. Or they're evil hip-hop moguls. And I was interested in that because I looked at earlier shows that were about the upper class, like Upstairs, Downstairs in the 70s. And we were supposed to identify with the maids in that show. When I spoke to people over the course of the book who were having trouble, say, getting new jobs, they said they'd binge watch and then they'd get really depressed. They'd watch these shows. They'd eat, like, even Mad Men, and they'd, like, lose themselves in the decor, and then they'd be, like, hurtled down to earth where they're struggling to stay in the middle class. So I sort of see it as, like, a new kind of... look, I love these programs, but they're a new opiate of the masses.
But they're depressing. I mean, I'm curious about the psychology of it because, like, you know, we do have stuff like, I think they're rolling out a, relieve your debt, like literally a game show where they're going to pay off.
Oh, I just wrote about that.
Okay. Well, there you go.
I interviewed that guy. I can tell you about that.
Yes, please do. Yeah. Because, I mean, also this, like, and there was, I think, another one about, there was like, you know, if you're foreclosure underwater, they would fix your debt. We've had things like Undercover Boss, which again is sort of like, we're going to show you that your boss is actually a great guy. And, you know, this type of, all of this seems to be, creating some type of dynamic, like, right? Like the king is going to come down and say, I relieve you of your student debt. Oh, the king is so benevolent because one person got a feast. You know, someone got the turkey this year.
That show's a little different, and I actually write about it. Maybe I'll send it to you, and you guys can link to it. Because it just was published. But Michael Torpy, who is the host, his wife had student debt, and he came up with this idea of, this miraculous, you give away money to the winner of the winning contestant, gets their debt partially relieved or entirely.
Partially?
Partially? Right. Yeah, exactly. Well, they'd have to, that's a good point. They'd have to really win, which is a complicated thing. Like you have to, anyway, I've been watching this thing. Obviously I love my 1% TV. So he did have a personal story and he's really for debt forgiveness and it's almost like the debt collective, the TV show, you know, but there is also that oddness about it. It has this manic tone. It's comic. Its main inspiration seems to be that John Oliver show on debt relief. Do you remember that?
Vaguely, yes. Jubilee.
Yeah. So it has this kind of, this manic kind of comedic thing. And I talked to this scholar who's been studying these kind of TV shows, and she calls it, there's debt TV and then there's credit TV. And that was what used to exist. It was much more realist. And now this debt TV is like either horror or weird manic comedy because debt doesn't really exist, right? It's a imaginary category. So that's what this show is like.
And so, what do you make of these things? I mean, like, are these things a reflection of aspirations that we know can't be met, or is it there's something we're being trained to accept?
Yeah, I think they're training us to accept it. Or I think it's it actually, within the television universe, I feel like it comes out of this complicated TV that started with The Sopranos. So there are these morally complicated characters. But then now it's moving on to these, 1%, very, very rich characters who are morally complicated. And that starts to do something else. Like, no one who watches The Sopranos, like, God, maybe some people, I really want to be Tony. But I think, you watch Billions, you really kind of want to be Axe. And you're like, wow, this person is potentially, harming half of his employees every day, and that is strange. And, I would love people to start questioning it, even as they enjoy it or reading it critically. So that's part of what I was hoping this chapter would accomplish.
I want to talk also a little bit about what you came across in terms of, there's really two sets of policy ideas, right? That that to address this situation. One is, I think, you know, I would categorize as a good set of policy ideas. The others are sort of like makeshift. You know, what people are doing, like you, like the crowdfunding of various things. I mean, we see this now pops up where I don't know. I guess a couple of weeks ago we saw a news piece on, you know, a heartwarming story of an 11-year-old boy starting a lemonade stand to raise money for his parents who are having to pay for their, you know, 3-year-old who has some type of disease. And it's like, wait, this is not a heartwarming story. This is a horrible story that we're living in a society where an 11-year-old has to start a lemonade stand to pay for his 3-year-old brother to get health care.
Exactly. I mean, I spoke to people who were using GoFundMe to pay for daycare, to pay for diapers, to pay for maternity leave, to pay for school lunch. There's even a school lunch section of GoFundMe. So I spoke to like teachers who were raising money for like poorer students so they could actually pay for their school lunch. I mean, these are makeshift solutions. You know, some of them are like, I talked to people who are doing barter and trade, you know, my daycare for your, you know, housing, or my daycare for your food or whatever. And yeah, these are totally makeshift. This is what we're doing because, as I put in the book, like, our leaders are neglecting us. We're being, our wealth is going to the corporate sector. We're not seeing this. We're not getting our universal pre-K universally. You know, right now we have paid family leave for only 14% of the population. So, I mean, of the workers. So we need more.
What would, I mean, when you look at some policy prescriptions for these folks that you had spoken with, which ones seem like they would have the most impact?
Well, I definitely think, I mean, so many of them were struggling to pay for daycare, that I even wrote about something called extreme daycare, where people are now 9% of the population, if 9% of the daycares are now in off hours, so they're late at night or on weekends. And
24-hour daycare you'd written about. I had no idea that existed.
Yes, 24-hour daycare. And it's, as I said, it's a big swathe now of the daycares that exist. Who can pay for this if we're being asked to work all these different hours? And this is when you have close to full employment, right? Does that mean that people are working hours that help them? No. They may be working strange hours. They may be working irregularly, two different jobs, right? So we need better subsidized daycare for the middle class, too. We need, as I said, maternity leave, pregnancy leave, better protection against pregnancy discrimination. There's laws on the books, but the norms in offices are not great, right? You know, we need things like, as I said, universal pre-K, and I was even talking about universal basic income, which I know can be controversial, but I feel like now it's becoming more and more accepted. Yeah. You know, if some of those adjuncts had $20,000 a year for their disabled kid or their daughter, you know, so she could have ice cream, the kid would have ice cream.
I'm struck by how, you know, we have in New York now UPK, and I'm struck by how little attention it gets in the media.
I know. It's so weird. I feel like it's by far the best thing de Blasio has done. I'm very impressed at how quickly they rolled it out. I think they went from 20,000 to 60,000 seats or something in like 2 years.
It was amazing how quickly they rolled
amazing.
It out, how efficiently it amazing. Seems to be running, and the massive difference it makes in people's lives.
And I feel like this needs to be spread. It's like people are constantly talking about these disruptive ideas, and this is a simple idea. And, you know, I talked to one of the architects of it, and the thing that stuck with me was they were willing to have these pre-Ks in unusual places, like synagogues and churches and, you know, buildings that hadn't been traditionally used as schools. And I was like, that's the kind of thinking, that's the kind of good makeshift thinking that we can do locally, you know? So we're not just asking each other to do this for each other, but like local governments can be thinking more imaginatively like this.
Alyssa Quart, the book is Squeezed, Why Our Families Can't Afford America. We'll put a link to that and to your latest piece on the Get Out of Your Student Debt show at majority.fm. Thanks so much for your time today. I really appreciate it.
Oh, it's a pleasure, Sam. Thank you.
All right, folks, we're going to take a quick break. And when we come back, we're going to break our typical format today. And we're going to speak to a candidate for Congress in Massachusetts. I don't know too much about the race, to be honest with you, and I don't know too much about the candidate. I do know that she was a longtime single-payer advocate in the Massachusetts State, I think, Assembly or Senate. And she's running against, I think, is it Nikki Tsongas, who is on the... I think probably a little bit more to the right on the spectrum of Democrats that I would favor. But most importantly, Barbara Letalian went on Fox News and served them up a heaping dose of surprise, I guess. I don't know what I would call it. And we're going to ask her how she did that. We'll be right back after this. We are back. Sam Seder on the Majority Report on the phone. It is a pleasure to welcome to the program State Senator from Andover, Massachusetts, Barbara Letalian. She is running for the congressional seat in Massachusetts. I'm not sure. It's the third district and in the primary. And apparently there's nine other candidates. But Barbara, welcome to the program.
Thank you very much. Glad to be here.
So we played the clip earlier of you on Fox and Friends. And just to remind folks, Fox and Friends thought they were bringing on a primary candidate from Arizona. And I think it was the congressional 5th district in Arizona named Ann Kirkpatrick. And instead, Barbara, you were on there. Tell us what message you delivered. This was on a the hit was supposed to be a Democrat who is willing to stand up on behalf of ICE. And you more or less said what?
I basically said that I am a mother of four, and what we are doing with our border policy, separating children from their parents, is immoral, illegal, and inhumane, and talked about representing a large community, immigrant community in the city of Lawrence, Massachusetts, and that every single day I am concerned on the ground about people living in fear of being deported. I met with a young girl who was 12 years old, very concerned when she pulled me aside in a school one day to say that she's always afraid that when she goes home, her grandmother won't be there to take care of her anymore. And so I talked about what it must be like as a parent to, must be terrifying to be wondering if your child is ever going to be reunited with you. Obviously, we have not done a good job of that. It never should have happened in the first place. But we basically called them out and saying, you know, stop hurting Latino children to score political points with your base. We want kids to be reunited. There's trauma that's been happening. And this has always been a nation of immigrants. My grandparents came here from Canada and Ireland. And, you know, it's always been a welcoming country. We need to understand that people are coming in search of a better life for themselves and their families. Some people are leaving political violence. Some people are leaving drug trafficking violence. But everyone wants to come here and seek a better life for themselves and their family. And they've done it at great risk. And so I wanted to get on. I guess we crashed the party at Fox in the hope that if President Trump was listening, that he, you know, that he would listen to the very real concerns that I have and so many people have at the inhumanity that's been going on. So, you know, I am a candidate for Congress. I am not afraid to stand up to people and speak truth to power. I've always been that way. I will continue to be that way. And I'm going to do whatever it takes to represent the concerns of people in my third congressional district.
So, Barbara, how did you manage to do that? I mean, the look on the faces of those hosts was pretty precious. How did you manage to end up there? You're from Massachusetts. They were looking for someone in Arizona.
Yeah, they reached out to a member of my communications staff who had previously worked for the former congresswoman. And, you know, real due diligence on their part, right? They're not a news organization. They're an entertainment organization, and it's bad entertainment at that. But they reached out based on information and having that person's contact information from 10 years ago. And we saw an opportunity, and we took it.
Ah, that is so great. And wow, I feel like everyone involved in that deserves a medal because it's important. Honestly, you know, just I don't know if Donald Trump will be hearing that, but it is really important. I mean, just I think to the extent that there is any type of social disruption about particularly these policies and these type of policies, I think is crucial. I couldn't agree more with what the way you characterize these policies. Absolutely despicable what we've done in terms of not just the essentially kidnapping these kids, but also our immigration policies are absurd. And I want to just touch on briefly what other, you know, now we have an opportunity to introduce you to people in Massachusetts, around the country. You have been, I know, sponsoring a single-payer health care bill in the Massachusetts State Senate, I guess, for almost a decade. Is that right?
Yes, I've been a big believer in single payer as, again, the most humane approach to helping people get the health care they need. Having insurance doesn't necessarily mean you have health care if you can't afford the copays, deductibles, the caps on service, you can't afford your medications. I think we need to aspire to and move towards a single payer universal Medicare for All program. You know, I was actually in Massachusetts and voted on what was then known as RomneyCare, which tried to get us to 97% coverage of folks here in Massachusetts. But again, if that coverage isn't affordable, and if we go backwards where the Trump administration seems to want to go in terms of working with folks that have pre-existing conditions, then we are going in the wrong direction. So I've been endorsed up here in Massachusetts by the MassCare group, which has been pushing for single payer up here for a very long time. I've worked on healthcare policy for 15 years. I was motivated and ran for office because of my son with autism. When I started 15 years ago, you know, I was paying for a policy for my son, and yet he could not get what he needed within his diagnosis of autism. So was able to pass two pieces of legislation to make that easier for the tens of thousands of kids behind us in Massachusetts that really need supports and services through their medical insurance. So I've been working on medical insurance issues for a long time. We have an issue up here in Massachusetts around safe staffing in hospitals as well, making sure we have enough nurses on board. So I've got the support of the nurses up here, as well as teachers, the National Education Association. So I've been a progressive, working in the trenches for 15 years. I could tell you my story about getting kicked out of the Catholic Church over standing up for gay marriage in a very active way when I was a freshman back in 2004. I've been in the trenches for a long time, and I'm not afraid. I'm a very strong leader that always tries to carry sort of my mom values forward of care and compassion and persistence.
And Barbara, let me just ask you, there's nine other people running in this primary. Have you, obviously you've, I don't know if you've run before, but you certainly have been, I'm sure, aware of what's happened in that district in terms of the seat. And I think it's Nikki Tsongas who has been in that seat, and she's been in that seat for a long time, as far as I can.
11 years. Yes.
What has changed? Has something changed if from your perspective on the energy within the Democratic Party at the moment?
I think it's palpable. I noticed it right after Trump's election, noticed it during the Women's March. Long before this congressional seat opened, we did an activist forum in my major city of Lawrence. We had over 200 people show up. We were trying to plug them into a bunch of different ways that they could get involved, be it with healthcare, the environment, transgender rights, LGBTQ rights, education, public education. So we have seen a real growth in folks that realize they can no longer sit on the sidelines. They need to plug in and stand up something. And so we have seen that activism in place here in the 3rd Congressional District.
Barbara, thank you so much for joining us. We're going to put a link to your website if folks want to go find out more and support you in the myriad of ways that people offer support to candidates. And really appreciate your coming on, and can't thank you enough for your comms person for showing up on Fox, and at the very least, just making those people who are interviewing you feel somewhat uncomfortable about trying to shill for these horrible policies.
Absolutely, my pleasure to be with you, and I have no regrets on what I did today. I think it shows strong leadership.
All right, thanks again. Bye bye.
Thank you. Bye bye.
There it is.
That's hilarious.
So great.
Falls into your lap, you got to take it and run with it.
So great. I mean, the idea of like the whoever that person was whose name was on file for them coming up and saying, "Hey guys, I just got, I got an idea that might just be so crazy it might work." And that type of, honestly, like, I think it's easy for people to think that you can overstate the value of that type of attitude, but that is something you do not see in people who work around politics, willing to take that type of risk, where it's like, there's no downside, obviously, if they just don't return the phone call. No one's ever going to walk around going, that Barbara Letalian, she had an opportunity to hoodwink Fox and she never took it. No one's ever going to say that. No one's ever going to know. But to lean into an opportunity like that, and she clearly has some great politics. And this is, again, we're talking about nine candidates in that district. I imagine folks could do worse. So we will put a link to her site in Massachusetts. Folks, just a reminder, this program relies on its members for its support. every day we try and give you 45 minutes to an hour of free show with authors, sometimes occasionally people running for office. If you enjoy it, why not become a member? Go to jointhemajorityreport.com. If you just want to do a one-off donation, you can go to jointhemajorityreport.com, do a one-off donation. If you want access to the fun half, you can go to jointhemajorityreport.com. And if you don't have the resources, send us an email at majorityreporters@gmail.com. Tell us you want the fun half. We will hook you up. We will not lock anyone out for financial reasons. Also, just coffee.coop, fair trade coffee, tea, or chocolate. Use the coupon code majority, get 10% off. Today is Monday. Tomorrow night is then Tuesday, as far as I know, unless something changes. It will be the Michael Brooks Show evening. Who will be on the Michael Brooks Show on Tuesday?
Matt. I need your help on this one.
Matt will be on.
Matt will be the guest. No, Marissa.
Marissa Baradaran.
Marissa Baradaran will be the guest. We've got some Middle East stuff to cover and a bunch going on. And also, what is the URL, Matt? We just put up our own YouTube channel for TMBS clips as well, if people want to start checking that out.
It looks like we have to we have to change that.
All right, we'll get to that later. Okay, fine. Available on Patreon, iTunes, and of course the Majority Report channel.
Clips are being
show.
Published. The post game should be available this evening.
Last week's post game at Matt Taibbi, where we had a lot of fun.
And Matt, literary hangover this week.
Yep, Young Goodman Brown, whopping 2 hours. You get the full short story in there with it and some biographical info for Nathaniel Hawthorne. I think people should check it out.
Whopping 2 hours.
Yep.
Don't forget to check out The Antifada.
A lot more people noticing Nathan Hawthorne.
Patreon.com/TheAntifada for Jamie's co-hosted show. All right, folks, going to take a quick break. When we come back, we will be in the fun half. You can call us at 646-257-3920. I am now opening up the phone lines. You can IM the show. Oh, I should tell you, we had problems with the Android app. It should be now back in the Google Play or wherever you get your Android apps. Should be up there and working much better. Check it out. You can always go to majorityapp.com for the link. We'll be right back.